here I am talking in front of statistical physicists about research that is new for me. So your job is to ask questions, and I'll write the questions down because you'll ask a lot of questions I won't know the answers to. So I got involved with some auditory people in my department, Dan Sain's lab, and they're interested in mechanisms having to do with sound localization at some of the earliest stages in the auditory system. Some of the first places where inputs from the two ears come together. So I'm going to be talking about neurons in those areas that are responsive to the timing of impulses. Okay, so that's, and this is my, this is the first composition of my PowerPoint stuff. So let's see, how do I do this? Oh, there's only a couple things that are going to come in from the side, so don't worry about it. It's, I was just playing with it. So these cells have interesting properties, and the whole system, this early part of the auditory system, is like well designed for timing. Okay, so we're going to be talking about neurons that are coincidence detectors. They're detecting the arrival of coincident inputs from the two ears. So the simplest thing is to think of a pure tone coming in, and if it's over here, it hits this ear before it hits this ear. And so someplace is some neurons that detect when the inputs from these two sides converge, and then those neurons light up. So in the mammals, it's called the medial superior olive. And in birds, it's called the nucleus laminaris, this region where the first convergence is. And why we study birds, because that was a very handy experimental system. It wasn't that long ago where people first been able to do cellular neurophysiology on these areas. And the chick was a good experimental preparation. So these neurons, in response to steady inputs, fire one action potential, one impulse at the beginning of the stimulus. They do not fire repetitively for maintained stimuli. So there is this notion that this phasic firing property is important for these cells because they detect rates of change, they detect sudden coincidences of inputs, and so this is a key feature of their highly precise temporal processing abilities. That's the gestalt that people carry around with them. Okay, and these cells are very strongly phase locking. auditory nerve fibers can come in and fire up to 300 hertz, and if they're coincident on these cells, they can follow up to 200-300 hertz one for one. If the frequency gets faster than that, or you have multiple inputs coming to a cell, the effective frequency is more than that, because they're not all synchronized, and not all fire in every cycle. These neurons don't fire at every cycle. They start skipping beats, but still when they fire at precise phases. So they can phase lock with high precision up to 2 kilohertz in some cases. Okay. So some of the biophysical properties are that the synaptic currents in these cells are very, very fast. We're talking on the time scale of a millisecond or submilliseconds, the duration of the conductance changes that go with these synapses. Before you get to the convergence place of these two sides, there is a relay station, and in that relay station, it's almost one for one auditory nerve onto a relay neuron, and the synaptic footprint is a very big synapse. It covers a good portion of the cell body. This is called a calical synapse. It's a very secure synapse. You get one impulse out for one nerve pulse that comes down the auditory nerve. These coincidence detecting cells are like bipolar cell body, dendrites hanging out this side, dendrites hanging out this side. Inputs from one ear come here, inputs from the other ear come here. They're separated. There's highly designed specific features of the anatomy of these things. And in some species, the dendritic length varies with the frequency. There's a tonotopic map from the cochlea up into higher levels of the auditory system, where there's certain bands of neurons, certain slabs of neural tissue that are dedicated to certain frequencies. So the cochlea divides the sound up into different frequency locations, and that gets transferred up to different populations of cells. So in some of these coincidence detecting cells, the length of these dendrites varies with the isofrequency band they're in. Lower frequencies have longer dendrites, higher frequencies have shorter dendrites. It's been an intriguing issue why it is like that. What advantage does the system gain from that particular design principle? So the synaptic currents are very fast, and the intrinsic currents that generate action potentials are very fast. And there's one specialized current in these systems, a low-threshold potassium current. So for those of you who know about, does everybody know about Hodgkin-Huxley and how action potentials are generated, fast sodium and slower potassium? This potassium current comes on below the spiking threshold. Okay, so the way I talk about this is it's sort of a negative feedback that comes on, that can come on before the spiking threshold. So why would you do that? Okay.
This is why the neuron fires only once.
This is the current that takes the blame for that phasic firing property. So it's important.
It's fast on, slow off.
It's fast on and relatively fast off, but long enough to. It doesn't inactivate. Hyperpolarize it, it goes on, but it doesn't inactivate. Except on a very slow time scale, possibly. Yeah. We think of that as not important. It's an outward current. Comes on.
So you said that. Sort of a mystery why the high frequency the dendrites are short. But so it seems to me, right? So if a high frequency cell, you want to be able to resolve very short time distance differences. So if you have a long dendrite, the pulse that comes into the dendrite, it spreads out before you get to the
cell.
So that seems to me.
There is this spreading phenomena and the tuning, the filter properties of the dendrites and matching and so on. That's one of the stories. Yeah. Okay. So we worked on that problem with Catherine Carr. Hagai Eigmanstner was a student of Idan Segev. But this is what I'm going to talk about today. So I'm going to tell you about some theory and experiments that are trying to understand the role of this phasicness and this particular potassium current. And Gita Svirsky is a senior postdoc in my lab. He's from Lithuania. He's a theoretician and experimentalist. He worked with these guys in physiology at Copenhagen, the motor neuron guys, Hunsgaard and Ulakin and so on. They studied bistable properties of motor neurons. And Dan Sains is the lab director that does the experiments on these kind of cells, and also another nucleus in the lower auditory system, and he's a postdoc with him. So the message is going to be about this low threshold potassium current is going to help you increase the signal to noise ratio by eliminating false positives. That's going to be the bottom line.
So this is a current which is also present in motor neurons? The slow AHP?
No, this is not slow, this is fast.
No, I mean the decays.
I don't...
It's a curve which, I think there's one HP curve which...
I don't know about that. Yeah. I don't know, because they fire tonically, a lot of these motor neurons.
And very, very other ways.
As far as I know, they have, you know, pretty good FI relations. I don't know if it is there. Don't know. It's a current that's very specific, and, you know, I don't know if you follow any of this ionic channel stuff, but these are called KV 3.1, 3.2. They're blocked by the molecular biologists have gotten into this. Okay, so you characterize the tuning properties of these cells by imagining a pure tone at some location in space. So there's a time difference at the arrival of the two ears, and you are in a cell and you characterize its responsiveness as a function of the interaural time difference. Okay, that's the phase difference between the two inputs, and if they're correct, you get high firing rate, and if they're incorrect, you get a very low firing rate, sometimes nothing. Basically out of these cells. So, however, most of the cells, the auditory nerve is kind of spontaneously active. It just spontaneously fires at 30, 40 hertz.
But you actually only get one spike of phase?
It depends on the frequency, right? If you're above 200-300 hertz, you're going to start skipping beats. Okay?
Do you ever get more than one spike of phase?
I don't think people have really looked at that superharmonic stuff. Well, you shouldn't. At very low frequencies, these cells won't fire. Okay?
Wait, did you say they're spontaneously active?
I said the auditory nerve is spontaneously active, right? Yeah.
What are these 440 or 449 hertz?
I don't know. That could be. This is from a barn owl. This is for, and they phase lock at much higher rates, okay? And they're, I mean, it's interesting that they detect, you know, very fine, this time scale is microseconds, okay? So they can detect things on the scale of, you know, 30, 40, tens of microseconds. We're talking about using action potentials that are on the scale of a half a millisecond wide to detect time differences on this, resolve time differences like that. So this is the model that, the conceptual model that Jeffress put together 60, 70 years ago. And his idea was that you have inputs coming in from one side, counterflow inputs coming in from the other side. So if the input comes here first, the inputs will meet down here. And if this cell is very good at detecting coincident arrivals, that cell is going to light up, but the others won't. Okay? If this guy comes in first, this cell is going to light up. So it's this delay line and then having coincidence detectors that is part of this sound localization model. Okay, so this is some cellular electrophysiology from those relay neurons and coincidence detecting neurons in the chick, in the chick. So here you see, in response to a step of current, different size steps of current, that super threshold gives you just one action potential. Okay, if you put a hyperpolarizing current on, you see that the time constant is much longer. Okay, the conductance is much less, but as soon as I start to depolarize a little bit, the time constant is much faster. Okay, so there is this sub-threshold conductance that comes on to change the membrane time constant very, very close to the resting membrane potential. Okay, so we talk about, this is the voltage axis, and we talk about this low threshold conductance coming on close to rest. There's, of course, a high threshold potassium conductance that cuts the action potential and makes it very fast. But this is the guy that people talk about. And here's sort of the steady state current voltage relation of the membrane below threshold. So down here it has a certain conductance, and then suddenly the conductance increases dramatically before you get the firing threshold, which would be minus 40, minus 45, something like that. So it is this strong rectification that's caused by this current here. And that's what we're interested in. Okay. So this is the structure, the system that SANES works on, and what we work on is the gerbil. So you take a slice out of the gerbil brainstem where these structures are, and you record individual neurons in this slice. But this is the structure. So here is the input coming in from one ear, from the other ear. The excitatory input comes in to one side and from the other side to the other set of dendrites. But in this system, there's also another set of inputs that come from that side that passes through another place where the sign gets converted into inhibition. So there's both excitatory input and inhibitory input to these cells, and these pathways are spontaneously active. Okay, so we're going to be thinking about the subthreshold responsiveness of this system, and we're going to be thinking about spontaneous activity coming in and then some signal coming in. We're going to talk about the detection of that signal in the presence of this random spontaneous activity that's all subthreshold.
So the regional neurons are also playing spontaneously?
Yeah, there's some spontaneous stuff coming out of these guys. Tens of hertz.
Are the excitatory inhibitory correlated?
Boy, I don't think so, but I don't know if anybody's really examined that real carefully. I mean, this is really hard to do this stuff in vivo, right? And this is all in a slice, right? So in the slice, there's very little spontaneous activity, of course.
So what part of it is the slice?
This right here. This right here, this is the MSO. These are the cells that we're going to. We're hoping, I mean, right now we're just sticking electrodes in and stimulating the cells, mimicking spontaneous input. And at some point we hope to be able to drive these inputs. Not right now, we're not.
You say that the stimulus coming in, you meant in vivo.
In vivo, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about two kinds of models. We've got an integrate and fire model with this low threshold potassium current, and we've got a Hodgkin-Huxley model. And we're using for data this voltage clamp data that was produced by Rothus and Trussell from the chick. Okay, so they did voltage clamping on these cells in a slice. So we take that, and then we have a sodium and potassium current that we pulled out of somebody else's spiking model.
Not for these neurons.
Not for these neurons, no. It's just a spike generator. So this is not going to be like a real quantitative model. This is semi-quantitative, qualitative kind of stuff. So I'm plotting here the current voltage relations of these three currents, the two spike generating currents and the low threshold current. So this is the sodium current, if you think of it as fast activating and forgetting about the inactivation. It has this, it's an inward current, fully activated, and then it has a linear part up here when it's fully activated. Okay, so, and the high threshold potassium current comes on a little after, this is voltage here, comes on a little after the sodium current and saturates. But this low threshold current comes on in regions before either one of them, in voltage ranges before either one of them comes on. So I magnified that over here. This is all looking at this as steady state. Okay? Steady state. So when we do the responsiveness to steps of current, okay, we see that this model makes this cell fire just one action, allows it to fire just one action potential.
To a step
of current. These are hyperpolarizing steps and then depolarizing steps, so this is different current step amplitudes. Okay.
Eventually.
Sorry?
How long?
Oh, yeah, so if you put enough current in, it will. Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, no, no, a stronger current, then it will fire a piston.
In this case, are you going
to
pay to infinity and it will not?
No, won't. It's got a stable rest state out here. This is just a transient impulse. But if I...
will stay on the slow potassium because the voltage will go to something which is just below threshold.
Yeah.
This is not hyperpolarizing.
This is depolarizing here, right? But it comes on then. It's on. If I take this current away, if I take this current off, this cell will fire repetitively in some of these ranges shown here. Okay. So in a sense, it's sort of shifted the threshold for repetitive firing up. I mean, if you worked really hard, you could probably make a model that didn't. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's the duty cycle to get it back? What does it have to do to reset so we can respond to the next?
If you get transient inhibition here that lasts on the time scale of a millisecond or so in this model, it will reset. The time constant that we're using for this guy in these models is on the order of a millisecond or two.
So another is an inhibitory hit reset.
Yeah.
So FI curve has, but you say if the current is high, you will get your repetitive fire.
Yeah, it's
so
like
there is a gap between the firing for one spike.
Yes.
And firing repetitive.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it's not as dramatic in this model. Yeah. It's not as dramatic. We had, I mean, so because we took this other Hodgkin-Huxley model and made its membrane time constant more on the scale of a few milliseconds rather than, this is almost like tens of milliseconds here. Partly based on our experiments, okay, we didn't see that dramatic a thing, a difference.
How big is the gap between the single strike fires and repetition?
I don't remember. You mean like in terms of current strength or something?
But the threshold potential for this firing is more or less the same.
Yeah.
It doesn't change much.
If it's a fast input.
What?
If it's a fast input.
Right.
Yeah, right. Okay, so this is the idealized model that we made for integrate and fire. So integrate and fire, so here's an integrate and fire neuron. Okay, we've added on this potassium-like conductance. So the way we think about it is, this is the IV steady-state IV relation for integrate and fire. It's linear. So we imagine that at some voltage above rest, between rest and threshold, conductance, a rectifying conductance, turns on with a certain time constant, tau KLT. Okay, so this is our simple integrate and fire model of this. And I don't show it here, but we also put a fast AHP potassium. After it spikes, it undershoots and comes back to rest on the time scale of a millisecond or something.
It could just reset,
right?
I still don't see why it is here, because even before you want to hit the first spike, you still have to pass through this.
So you can sort of see it on this picture, right? If you see it on the steady state. If I put a current in above here, it's going to fire repetitively if this thing doesn't exist. Okay? And it won't fire repetitively if this thing is a steady state IV relation. But now I'd have to put it over here to make it fire repetitively.
Yeah. The question for the first spike is because tau is slow enough.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. It depends on the time scale at which this gate opens or closes.
It could be one spike, could be two spikes.
It depends on how fast. Exactly.
So what is tau KLT?
A millisecond or two.
And
everything's fast. The membrane time constant is a millisecond.
Why didn't AHP shut it off?
Oh,
when you said it.
Hmm?
Why didn't AHP reset that?
It can. Yeah, it will. In this model, it will.
Okay.
Yeah. After a spike, yeah.
So if you would, instead of giving a pulse, you would ramp it up, then...
I'm going to show you that, I think. Oh, there it is, yeah. Okay, so this is the response to different speeds of ramp. Okay, if the ramp is very slow, okay, and I stop it before it gets there, okay, it doesn't fire repetitively.
Okay.
It doesn't. Yeah, but if I make the ramp faster, yeah, that doesn't fire at all. But if I make the ramp faster, then it fires. Okay, so that's the response to a ramp.
Do neurons also have repetitive firing for firing outcome?
We don't push them that hard. I mean, in the experiments, most of the neurons that we stick have this phasic firing property.
Yeah, but this would predict that you just go a bit higher.
We don't push them that hard. I mean, over a reasonable range. If, well, I'm going to show you, if we block this current, those neurons fire repetitively in many cases for the same range of currents. Okay. Oh, so this is my video. Let's see if I can make it work. Okay. So when I turn time on, you're going to see this gate open, and this is giving a ramp of current to this neuron. So the membrane potential time course is going to be up here, and this gate is going to open with a certain time constant. So you see the current coming on, the voltage increasing, the gate opens and keeps it from firing. And over here, this guy, if it's a fast enough ramp, it can get up past there before that gate opens, and it'll fire an action potential. Okay, so let's go.
I don't see though the difference between doing it for the first time and for the second.
There was still some left over. There was still a little bit left over.
So it's not reset.
It wasn't instantaneously reset.
It's not reset.
Yeah, it continues for a little bit. Okay, so this is more of the same. This is response to different steps of current. Okay, this is the square steps of current. And you see if I go, this is the firing threshold. And here's where the current turns on down here. So you see the cell wanting to go up to that potential level, but the current turns on and pulls it down a little bit. Pulls it down. Okay? If I put enough current in, I get a spike. There's a spike here. AHP, steady. If I put enough current in, it fires repetitively. Okay. Okay, so this is the setup now for us to start thinking about trying to detect a signal. So we're imagining this model neuron being bombarded with excitatory and inhibitory currents, okay, on the scale of a kilohertz or 1500 or something like that, small amplitude inputs. And then we imagine, so let's see. Okay, so there's excitatory inputs coming in, inhibitory inputs coming in, and then we imagine that there's a signal coming in, and that signal is still sub-threshold. It's about 60-70% near threshold, but it's going to be riding on this net random background, and so every once in a while it's going to fire. And we think of this as, say, some coincident arrival of some inputs. Okay. So that's the total current. Okay, and every once in a while it might get near threshold. This is the membrane potential computed from that current. It didn't cross threshold, it got close, but it didn't cross threshold in that time. Okay. So this is the post-stimulus time histogram for many trials of a signal. Okay, so this is the probability to fire per unit time. So if you look out here, this is the probability to fire spontaneously. So this is the spontaneous firing rate on the scale of 20-25 hertz or so out here. Okay? This is if there's no, and of course, the signal creates a high probability to fire after it's presented, because it's riding on some excitation inhibition. Yeah?
I'm going to help you. I think you said a while ago that these cells don't fire spontaneously.
The auditory nerve fires spontaneously.
So let's look at the red curve.
And so, yeah, so this is if I remove that KLT. They do fire at a very low rate. If I add that low threshold potassium current, I decrease the spontaneous firing rate. Okay? And of course, I've added a potassium conductor, so I also decrease the probability to fire in response to the signal. But these two decrements are different. Okay, so the basic idea is that you've had a more profound effect on the probability to fire to spontaneously than to the signal.
But you could just increase the threshold.
Sorry?
You could just increase the threshold. If that's what you want to get, just increase the threshold, what would that be?
Well, let's see. I think I would decrease both of these probabilities, but maybe not in such a non-uniform way. Okay, and there's also a time constant associated with this thing. There's a dynamics associated with this low threshold potassium current. Okay, so what I've eliminated a lot of here is the summation of some of these synaptic inputs that lead to enough to cause this thing to fire. Okay, they're slow enough that this thing turns on and keeps those, but the signal is fast and it can get through. Okay.
John,
yeah.
If you decrease the amplitude of the spontaneous excitation inhibition,
yeah,
but you increase the excitation relative to the inhibition,
yeah,
so that the spontaneous rate stays the same,
yeah,
then presumably the response will be less to the instantaneous because you start. So your voltage is now very close, continues to stay even close to the threshold,
yeah,
which means that you always have this slow potassium current turned on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we didn't think about doing that.
I think what you sort of want with the random inputs,
yeah,
is that the distribution of voltages is large enough that
to keep it more or less turned on.
Yeah,
so we didn't mess around with that. These are almost balanced to keep the net near rest.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be a good parameter to play with. Okay, so this is now looking at this another way. So this is the spike triggered average input that creates on average an action potential. So this is the reverse correlation of the inputs that creates a firing. So this one without the low threshold potassium current is this one. Okay, so it's telling you that it needs a net excitation on the time scale of a couple of milliseconds to generate an action potential. Okay, if I add KLT, this low threshold potassium current, it's going to need more input because now you've got some potassium current. But it's sort of shortened the integration time. So it's created a different integration time window. So in that sense, you might say, well, it's increased the temporal processing properties of these cells. In some of the neurons that you look at, this low threshold potassium current comes on closer to rest or less close to rest or so on. So we sort of use that as a parameter. And now we moved the gating properties of this closer or almost on at the resting membrane potential. Okay, so that gives this blue curve. There's more potassium current around. You've got to hit it harder to get a spike. But it's got this negative dip to it here. Okay, so how we interpret that negative dip as saying, since there's enough of this potassium current around at rest, a good input is to have some inhibition come first to remove that and then hit it with fast excitation. So that's this negative thing right here. Okay. it. So now I'll show you some experiment. Oh, wait, this is for the Hodgkin-Huxley model. To say this before. So this is the control case, the signal-to-noise ratio. This, now we've actually taken that PSTH, normalized it by subtracting the baseline, and then divided by the baseline. That's what we call the signal-to-noise ratio. The probability to fire in response to the signal relative to spontaneous probability. Okay? And the standard neuron has a much higher, the case with this low, has a much higher signal-to-noise ratio than the one when you block that current, when you remove that current. So that's what we're thinking about, is how this current is helping the signal detection. It's increasing the signal-to-noise ratio by eliminating some of that spontaneous firing.
The signal-to-noise
ratio is the PSTH peak. To take the PSTH, subtract the baseline, and then divide by the probability to fire spontaneously.
It's very sensitive to the...
To the baseline. Exactly, right, yeah.
So anything which will eliminate...
Yeah.
Will make it very...
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what we think about it. And so this is the... I was just showing you the reverse correlation. Okay, so these are the experiments that were done. Okay, so actually here you see the response of one of these cells in a slice to different current steps, and here you do see that bigger change. We could have modified this model to be more effective at that, but so here you see this big change in time constant and the phasic firing properties. Okay, here is a slow ramp of current up and down. Cell doesn't fire. Faster up and down ramps, cell fires in response to that. Fast input. Okay. Now this stuff here is known to block this particular kind of potassium channel, so it's very specific. So when you put that on the neuron, these currents make it fire repetitively. So it converts this cell from phasic to tonic. Okay, people have seen this kind of stuff with other blockers and other cells like this in the auditory system. And so big deal is it converts it from phasic to tonic, and therefore you understand how it can do temporal processing, this current. So now the slow ramp here causes a lot of action potentials. Okay, and this is the current voltage relation, sub-threshold. So you see the rectification here.
So what is the time constant of this current?
Of the current? So we didn't do this voltage clamp, but you can sort of get a feeling for this is sort of a voltage clamp. It's not as rigid as one would like because we don't have spatial control over this cell, and we didn't do an extensive analysis. But if you step the voltage up, you see the current coming on here with a time scale of a couple of milliseconds, say.
So it's pretty fast.
It's pretty fast.
But you have an idea of the membrane time constant?
Well, the membrane time constant is seen if we're not getting much of this current up here. Okay, it's also pretty fast.
So why for hyperpolarizing current it's so slow? Looks like very slow.
Yeah, well, so... Here it's way down here. There may be some other stuff going on down here. I don't know what this is all about. That's really slow. But down in here, it's on the order of 5 milliseconds or so. But this is one example of a cell. So Gita says, in his view, these cells have time constants on the order of a couple of milliseconds. Sorry. Well, it is, because you see just a little bit above rest, this other guy is coming on. So it is changing tau. So it's hard to kind of talk about the resting membrane time constant. Okay, so this is doing this simulation in the neuron. So now we are injecting this neuron with barrages of synaptic inputs generated in the computer. So this is done by mimicking conductance changes and using this technique of dynamic clamp to inject the currents that correspond to those conductance changes.
Does that include conductances or currents?
It's conductances that are converted into currents, okay?
But
so you know this technique of dynamic clamp?
In the integrated fire model that you showed before.
I think,
you said the input was
yeah,
current.
Yeah, it was, actually it was conductances there as well.
Basically.
Yeah, okay. So the control case, is this one. So it has this spontaneous firing rate out here. Okay, this is on the order of 10 hertz or so. And you block that potassium conductance and it drops the spontaneous rate. It didn't drop the peak very much, so if you take this ratio, as I said, the signal to noise ratio is up by a factor of 5 or 6 for this simulated signal in the presence of noise case. This particular neuron has this feature of the current being on near rest, so it has this dip in the reverse correlation indicating that it's good to remove some of that potassium conductance before you hit it with an excitatory input. Okay. Okay, so look at this narrowed integration window and ask about phase locking in response to periodic inputs. Okay. So now what we've done is put barrages of Poisson inputs whose rate depends on time. Okay, so it's periodically modulated synaptic excitation and inhibition being delivered to this model neuron, and the modulation rate is about 500 hertz. Okay, so there's inputs coming in like that, and the cell fires, and you get a post-stimulus time histogram that is periodic function responds after you deliver these EPSPs and IPSPs. Okay. This is the output, and this is the input. This is just a schematic. Okay, actually it's only firing once every 10 cycles. It's hard to tell.
So
there's many rasters there.
There's no background. There's no spontaneous input.
No.
So the jitter and the input you just put in by hand?
Yeah, just Poisson.
Oh, awesome.
Okay. This is the Poisson rate. So if you fold all those cycles together and look at the period histogram, so this is the probability to fire per unit time during a cycle. Okay, so this is with this KLT present, and this is without this KLT present. Okay, if you measure the so-called vector strength, like just as Kuramoto measures vector strength, you know, you look at the phase, the average phase vector, and measure that vector. Here it's dropped way down. So when I take away this current, the synchronization quality of this cell drops way down. And a lot in non-meaningful portions of the cycle. When it shouldn't be firing, it's firing. So this is getting a lot of false positives, which is making this vector strength so low. Okay, it's as if it's being hit by random inputs. So now we plotted with the model the vector strength as a function of cycle period. So this is increasing frequency going this way, 200 hertz, 500 hertz. Okay, and this is the standard integrate and fire model. Vector strength drops off, of course, as you increase the frequency. But if you've got this low threshold potassium current present, the vector strength is higher. At each frequency, the vector strength is higher.
Give this effect of this one, that's not.
Yeah, this is for the integrate and fire, and this is for the Hodgkin-Huxley. Okay, standard Hodgkin-Huxley, and with this low threshold potassium current present, increases the vector strength.
So why is there a bigger, stronger effect with
Hodgkin-Huxley? I don't know.
So the Hodgkin-Huxley, you say standard. What do you mean by standard?
sodium, potassium activation and aggregation.
I mean, what is the FI curve, for instance?
This FI curve, I don't remember if it's type 1 or type 2. This is a model that Gita's pulled out of a paper by Maynard and Sosnovsky. Okay? So what, you know, he just wanted to make spikes.
Is that standard?
Did I say, I shouldn't have said standard, okay. I should have said Sosnovsky. Okay. Okay, so this is now doing that experiment in the MSO cell. So this is with the current present and without the current present. So the vector strength, after you block that current, dropped by 30% or something like that. Okay, so here you see, especially during the bottom parts of the cycle here, you're getting a lot more firing than you are here. This is an example from another cell. Okay, the control case had vector strength 0.63, and after blocking, dropped by a half, almost a half. Okay, again, during the non-meaningful parts of the stimulus, it's pretty flat in here, so it's eliminated some of those false positives. Okay, so this, you've got the message now. We've eliminated false positives by using this current. It enhances the signal-to-noise ratio, improves threshold phase locking, and we think of it as a dynamic threshold modulation. It has a certain time scale associated with it. We did integrate and fire and Hodgkin-Huxley models. And there's one more thing I can show you. So these are, I mean, everybody that does slices uses young tissue, okay, before all the glial cells and all that stuff forms, so you can see the neurons and poke them and so on. So these cells, most of the cells that we looked at were 11 to 12 days postnatal, which is about the time of hearing onset in these gerbils. But we also did a few cases of older cells, like 15 to 17 days older. And there are some developmental changes that go on in these cells. This current is getting stronger as the cells mature. This is an example of a 17-day cell in which we blocked the current and the cell was still phasic. Okay? In this cell and in a couple of others that he did, this is not easy to do these older cells, but in a few of the other ones he looked at also, the current, blocking the current did not convert the cell from phasic to tonic. However, it did increase the signal-to-noise ratio.
But what is the mechanism?
So we're not entirely sure. One possibility is the gating properties of the sodium current. It could be, for example, that the inactivation of the sodium current could be coming on at a lower voltage. So a kind of a generalization that I like to think about is to think of a slow negative feedback process, a fast negative feedback process, not instantaneous, that comes on below spiking threshold. So there's a time window available to you to escape through, but after that, the negative feedback becomes effective and you don't fire another spike. So you could do this with this. It could be, the negative feedback could be an outward current, a potassium current that you turn on, or it could be turning off an inward current. So it would be counteracting the sodium activation is what this would be doing. So if you take the activation curve of the sodium current and the inactivation current and you push them apart a little bit, so inactivation can be stronger subthreshold, you can make this Hodgkin-Huxley model still be phasic without this KLT at all. So this is going to be an interesting thing for some of the auditory people to see, because some people had wanted the case solved. The potassium current is the one that makes the cells phasic, and that's responsible for all this improved temporal processing. But there could be multiple factors that contribute to it. So that's where we're at with it. We're hoping, one of the things we really want to do is to explore this business about the dendrites. So Svirsky's, I told you, worked in this lab where they studied motoneuron firing properties. And these motoneurons have interesting firing properties, interesting bistable firing properties. That is, for a certain range of currents, they can be firing at two different frequencies, or they can be not firing or firing, different kinds of bistability in these motoneurons.
Which animal?
They've done it mostly in turtles, okay, but people have seen it other places now. So for a certain range of currents, and a considerable range of currents, these neurons can either be not firing or firing repetitively, or can be firing at a lower frequency and a higher frequency. I don't know which motor neurons. I don't know if they're all that well classified in a turtle. But you dump certain stuff on serotonin, I think, is what you dump on to promote this kind of stuff. Well, anyway, the story is that there are some calcium currents in the dendrites that create plateau potentials. So if you get this neuron active enough or hit it with synaptic input, you turn on a plateau potential in the dendrite, which provides more current to the cell body. So you get to a certain point and you recruit this current, and suddenly a cell can fire a lot faster. And then you have to pull the current that you're delivering to the cell body way down in order to turn this dendritic current. And so anyway, Gidas got involved in these kind of experiments. So one of the tricks they used in these experiments to convince you that, help convince you that these currents were in the dendrites, was take the slice and put an extracellular field across these neurons. So when you put extracellular field across a neuron that has extended processes, okay, you create a potential gradient within the cell. Okay, the cell can be more depolarized in its dendrites than at the other end, depending upon the size of the field. So you can alter the ability to recruit or not recruit currents that are in the dendrites. So what we're hoping to do is try to use this technique in some of these cells to see if we can understand what kind of inputs are delivered to the dendrites, estimate what kind of inputs, and then deliver those inputs to the cell body without any dendritic input. So this means we need to find the afferent inputs to these neurons in the slice, stimulate them, estimate the size of the dendritic inputs and their character, then take them away, don't stimulate the afferent, and stick this into the cell body and see if we get differences in responsiveness to the inputs coming in from the dendrites. So we'll see. Okay.
There are basically two features of this panel. One is eliminating sort of spontaneous activity, and one of them is the phase locking. I think the phase locking seems to be more crucial in the sense that eliminating, as you mentioned here, eliminating spontaneous activity can do very well.
Yeah.
A new measure of the smart volume, even if it reduces the peak somewhat.
Yeah.
But phasing seems to be about those things.
Say that part. What?
The basic aspect of it.
Yeah.
You cannot probably do by simply changing, but without dynamic modulation of the pressure.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So we did a couple of things, like made some comments on this. People talk about this low threshold potassium current coming on. They say, well, it's like, you know, increasing the conductance, like changing the membrane time constant, shortening the membrane time constant. So we did that. We just forgot about the potassium current and changed the membrane time constant. Okay? So if you increase the conductance to the cell, you lower the spontaneous rate, and you also lower the peak, though, as well. You've changed the input resistance. So in this case, you change both of them in such a way that the signal-to-noise ratio didn't change very much. You improved it maybe by a factor of 1.5 or 2 or something like that, but not nearly as dramatic as when you had the dynamic aspect to this gate. I would like to make this point more strongly by designing another kind of experiment, a numerical experiment even, to drive home the point that just doing this, you've forgotten about the time constant of this gate. Okay, so if you get any thoughts about that.
What do you think about that? Did you dynamically speed it up and keep the threshold the same?
We kept the threshold. The only thing, this is standard integrate and fire here.
Dynamically, like change the, speed it up as you're getting close.
No, we didn't, there were no dynamics in this. Okay, this is just straight integrate and fire with two different membrane time constants.
Yeah, but I'm saying,
is that clear?
Yeah. But if you look at the, if you compare the two,
yeah,
not the signal to noise, but the phase aspect.
Yeah.
The phase locking.
Yeah. Yeah. So we didn't do that for this. Yeah, we didn't do that. That's okay. We should do that. Then of course, so there's a compromise here is, you know, increasing the membrane conductance, you decrease the firing probabilities. So if the signal gets too small, you're losing some signal throughput as well.
Right.
So that's what happens here. So here we, to get at more of this dynamic, we made the potassium conductance very fast. Okay, so you really kill just about everything. Now in this case, the signal to noise ratio hardly changed, but you've got no signal. Okay, so sort of a compromise here of what kind of speed you want out of this thing. The speed's, you've got to have some delay, but it can't be too much.
You need some information theoretic measure.
Well, that's what I was kind of wondering myself. Have you got any thoughts about that?
It means that the signal to noise ratio is not,
is not the only thing, right? Exactly. Yeah. Now that's hard, you know, that's great to do in a model, but that's really hard to do experimentally. Because you got to get a lot of action potentials, right? So this is hard work. Because you're intracellular.
You can do the model.
Yeah, we can do it with the model. Yeah, 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 I'd like to do that, yeah.
But John, to me it seems like there's two effects, right? Because you're increasing the threshold and decreasing the membrane time constant together, right? So you're making it more responsive.
Yeah. But increasing
faster with a higher threshold.
With a higher threshold, right. In the dynamic case.
In the dynamic case.
So right.
I'm wondering, like, is the dominant effect are both important, or is the dominant effect?
Well, I think both are important because here we just did the time constant, right? We kept the threshold fixed.
Right.
So we just changed the time constant. Okay.
But that just means that it's a faster neuron in general.
It's a faster neuron in threshold, but it's not dynamically faster,
you
right?
You increase the threshold current.
Sorry?
You increase the threshold current.
Oh, we did. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, because of the conductance, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So we didn't recompensate for that. The voltage threshold was the same, right? So we were doing fast inputs. Okay.
So.
Yeah.
So in this model, everything is purely feed forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, of course, in the case, we have a lot of these cells, and is anything known about the
connectivity
between these cells?
No, not that I know. People basically want to assume that it's feed-forward. I don't know if they know there is not any connectivity between these cells. I don't know if that's known.
Fast feedback.
Well, everything is fast.
So yeah. So I don't know, Carl. They always think of it as feed-forward. They always talk about it that way.
Right, because you think of a sort of network suppressing also, contributing to suppressing the false positive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, that's
how I would do it.
Yeah.
We would take all kinds of limits. That's the ones that inhibits everybody.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if anybody's done anything like, you know, recording from two cells. See if there's... We've been doing it real simple so far.
So I think this may have something to do with the auditory cortex also, but they're also probably phasic response.
They're phasic, but they don't, you know, by the time you get to cortex, these fine time scales are gone.
Right.
So they can respond phasically to amplitude modulated inputs, and there is still some phasicness up there, and there is. I don't know about auditory cortex. This probably wasn't even turned on. Oh, I don't know. Maybe it was. It's got to be really. Oh, okay. There are mechanisms for making phasicness on slower timescales. For example, familiar with the ability of thalamic neurons, relay cells in the thalamus, to burst. You hyperpolarize them, release, they burst. Or you hyperpolarize them and give them an excitatory input, they burst. Well, some of these cells, in response to hyperpolarization to certain ranges, will burst repetitively. Others only burst phasically. For example, in the cat, like Murray Sherman works on, you can't get those guys. If I hyperpolarize and move the current back up slowly, they won't burst at all. But if I jump the current up, they will. So there's a certain filtering property there that's phasic in the context of these things that are timescales of tens of milliseconds. Okay. So who knows? Maybe you can make, I mean, Murray's made a little story about that in response, say, to modulatory inputs. The cell will fire, it'll fire in response to transient inputs, or burst in response to transient inputs, but not to modulatory inputs that are changing sort of the state of the system.